This is On Your Radar, a podcast series produced at WGN Radio with the medical professionals and staff at Rosecrans. I'm John Williams from WGN Radio. And if you have been a regular listener to some of these podcasts, you may know that this is our fifth series of podcasts. And in this particular podcast, we're going to talk about why it's okay to not be okay. We have been talking for the last year and a half or so about how we are all getting through the pandemic. There are enough stresses in our lives that might lead somebody to defer to drugs or defer to alcohol or have medical or mental lapses, and then add upon all of that the pandemic. And so maybe it's going to be okay to not be okay, or at least not the version of it that you used to be. Joining us in this podcast is Dr. Ray Garcia. He is the medical director of the Rosecrans Harrison campus. Dr. Garcia, welcome. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you. It's nice to be with you again.
You agree with that overall introduction? That is, the new normal, if you will, is not going to be the old normal, right?
That is correct. A lot has changed in the last couple of years, and I think we all need to reach some level of acceptance about that.
And, you know, is it possible, too, without sugarcoating that, that maybe the new normal will be better than the old normal? I think about businesses. Every avenue of society has had to change as a result of the pandemic. And in some instances, they discovered that businesses operate more efficiently or entertainers entertain more creatively. I wonder if about our mental or physical health, we could conclude that we're going to come out of this stronger. Is that possible?
I certainly think that is possible. I think we've learned a lot in the last couple of years, and we continue to learn about ourselves, about what's important, about what we do and how we do it.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
So I am a psychiatrist, and I am the medical director at the Rosecrans Harrison campus for addictions in Rockford, Illinois. I also have a private practice that is affiliated with Rosecrans for seeing people with mental health disorders, including addictions and other psychiatric conditions.
Have you seen a change in your patients or in the volume of patients in the last 18 months, 2 years?
Certainly. I think there's been an increase in demand for services, both for treatment of addictions as well as general mental health. We have not seen a decrease in the number of people need help, and if anything, I think more and more people need help due to issues with people relapsing with substances. We've seen an increase in overdose deaths. We've seen more anxiety and depression, so there's certainly a lot of work to go around.
Do people point to the pandemic per se? Are they aware, maybe, of what is causing these issues, the relapses and so forth?
I think for the most part, people are. People certainly point to the pandemic and to the circumstances surrounding it as major stressors, triggers contributing to either exacerbation or even the onset of their issues with substances and other mental health.
Give me a specific example, maybe not a patient per se, but speak a little more particularly about one of these cases or kinds of cases.
Sure. I can give you an example of someone who had been struggling a little bit with some anxiety in their lives, but once the pandemic began, they really felt threatened. They thought that because there's this uncertainty, there's this unknown, they felt like there's this unknown enemy out there that they felt threatened by, that they needed to protect themselves from. And so it started triggering some, really some symptoms akin to post-traumatic stress disorder.
Hmm. I don't know that we all appreciate that, we all meaning those who aren't so affected. I wonder if we validate the feelings that those people are having, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of times these things happen, and they are under the radar. Either the people are too caught up themselves with what they're going through and just trying to survive, And so they may not notice what's going on in the people around them. And certainly there are some people who just don't understand what's happening to them. Why are they having these feelings?
Yeah. In a minute, I'll ask you how we recognize them and what we or they can do about them. But I think people also perceive it as a measure of cooperation or even strength. It's like, come on, it's a pandemic. Let's go. We've got to get through this thing. You know what I mean, right?
Sure, sure. There's a certain sense of feeling like we got to just get through this and we just have to keep going. Although there is some benefit to that, I think that, it can be dangerous to ignore when we are reaching our limits, because it's just human to have limits. And so it's important to acknowledge that when we start reaching those limits.
And different people have different limits?
Yes. Some people may have more reserve than others, whether that's through genetics, whether that's through coping skills that they've already learned, whether it's because there are other things going on in their lives that are causing stress. So, yes, there's going to be different levels.
And just, I suppose, like before the vaccine or before the pandemic started, we didn't know who would be on team vax and who wouldn't be, who would be on team mask and who wouldn't be. And I guess there was no way to predict who was going to be more resilient than others. I think a lot of us know people, we go, wow, that person is really waylaid by this thing. They're really super cautious, super nervous around every nuance of the news. And then other people, it seems to just brush right by them. And I would not have been able to predict who was who. You know what I mean?
I agree. I think sometimes we're surprised at who is affected significantly, and sometimes it's surprising to find out who has been more resilient.
So then, what are some of the red flags? I mean, for me as an individual or maybe somebody at work, how do I distinguish which is which or how serious to take it?
I think it's important to pay attention to any change in behavior. So if somebody suddenly goes quiet, if somebody stops communicating, that can be a big red flag. If somebody who used to participate more actively and now they're sort of dropping out, people who sometimes they may actually be more just irritable. Maybe they're shorter in their temperament than they used to be. Maybe there's a change in their use of substances, like maybe somebody starts drinking more often than they used to.
Maybe it's hard to recognize some of these things, too, since we're so isolated. If you're still working from home, you have neither the benefit of the collegiality you get from working in a communal place, but you're also able to maybe hide, or people aren't able to notice what you're going through.
Not only that, but sometimes we may not be aware how bad it is for somebody else because we think that what we're doing is acceptable. You know, one of the things that people have been doing in order to try to cope is people have these Zoom gatherings, Zoom parties, but then they might include consumption of, alcohol or other substances during those events. And so it's seen as, it's just an acceptable part of what we're doing to cope, but one may not realize that maybe a member or some members of that group are actually starting to use excessively.
I just think in the workplace, too, that we're all trying to get back into the office. Everybody wants to, well, I don't know that everybody wants to, but that's obviously a common topic these days. I wonder how accommodating employers should be about the anxieties people have when they come back or the fact that they don't want to come back. Do you have any psychiatric advice about that?
I think that flexibility certainly could help. There are struggles that people have in terms of childcare, in terms of just taking care of their own health as this is all happening. And if there can be some flexibility with situations like work from home and other accommodations, I think that would help people to be able to function in the workplace and remain in the workplace.
trying to think of ways, too, that adults, the employers or the employees can sort of communicate the level of anxiety that people have, how disrupted they are. I know a member of my family has chronic headaches, and he and his dad will give it a number value, 1 to 10. I wonder if there'd be some use for something like that. Like, how are you all doing today? What's your mental health score? And I could say I'm a 3, and if I were honest about it, we should attend to that, right?
Absolutely, and something that we actually do in recovery treatment is we do a check-in. You know, we ask everybody in treatment to do a check-in every day and to actually do that. Rate, what is your day like today? And we do that at the beginning, and we do that at the end of the day. And I think that would be a helpful and healthy thing to do in other settings, like maybe like at work. Let's do a check-in. How's everybody doing?
Yeah, and maybe they assign it a value or a letter, or maybe they just verbalize it with a word or some post. But I have not heard of employers doing that. And yet it would be, and you can't do it if you've got 52,000 employees. But if you've got 20 people under your manage that you manage, you could do that, couldn't you?
Certainly. I mean, everybody has a supervisor, so I think that a supervisor could be the person that each person checks in.
And it would not be shared, as you and I sort of chart this course for companies. Do you think that I should engage people with their anxiety? I'm not a professional, so maybe I shouldn't. Maybe I'll start to give advice that isn't helpful. I don't know. What are your thoughts about us engaging one another in their anxieties?
Well, there's a saying we have in recovery that the opposite of addiction is connection. And I think that applies here. I think that connection is important to help deal with this. And so engaging is a good thing. You may not necessarily have to give advice, but just letting somebody know that you're there, that you're going to be able to listen. There's a lot to be said for having that, that ear that is going to be available to you.
Is what you and I are talking about right now addiction, say drugs and alcohol, or is it mental health, or is it both?
I think it's both. You know, I mean, and they really are very much interrelated.
Do you find that people who are struggling mentally with anxiety or depression are almost always self-medicating in some way?
In some way. That may not necessarily be with substances. That could be with certain behaviors, whether it's watching too much TV, spending too much time on the internet, sex. There are all sorts of behavioral addictions or coping mechisms.
Food?
Sometimes be maladaptive. Absolutely, food.
It's interesting because you and I are recording this in early January, but today we were talking on the radio about how Reese Witherspoon was saying, I'm going to try and develop some healthy habits. So I'm going to drink a glass of water, and I'm going to read an hour a day without interruption, and I'm going to get to bed early, and I'm not going to binge watch TV. And then Ina Garten, the chef and TV host, she says, well, I'm going to drink Cosmos every day, and I am going to binge watch, and I'm going to be on the internet, and I'm going to do Sudoku puzzles and sleep in. And the whole world is now trying to score Ina's reaction to Reese. Is she being snarky, or is she being funny? Lay a little wisdom on us about the exchange between the two there.
Yeah, I think that, sometimes people are certainly just trying to be funny, but, you know, in humor, there is that thread of truth, right? So I think sometimes people do feel that some of these behaviors, these soothing behaviors are the way to go. And, you know, there may be some of that that could be okay, you know, in moderation, right? Just like with anything. But it's that slippery slope that you have to be careful about.
I worry, though, that if you say, okay, to ensure that I don't go down that path, I'm going to have no alcohol, I'm not going to eat any fatty foods, and I'm not going to binge watch any TV, you're setting yourself up for failure. I mean, that's not a realistic course of action for most people.
Any unrealistic expectation, I think, is a setup for failure. So I'm a proponent of avoiding the word should. You know, I think it's better to look at things in a positive way. What are the things that I could be doing that are healthy? What are the things that I could be doing that are more positive for my life?
It's probably true also, I don't know, let's just get back to the maybe central theme of this podcast, which is that it's okay to not be okay. Is it your opinion that some baseline of anxiety, some measure of struggle that people are going through right now is going to be there for a while? It's not going to end next month. This may be a ongoing part of our adulthood post-pandemic.
Of course it is. Anxiety is a normal human emotion, and it serves a purpose. It is what also motivates us. It can protect us from danger. So there's some measure of anxiety that's normal. It's when it starts to rise to a point of diminishing returns that it becomes problematic.
Are you saying that it's not a bad thing that we're a little more uneasy these days?
Well, it certainly encourages to be more cautious. Without anxiety, then we're going to forge ahead without any concern about what we might run into.
Right. Yeah. Now we're running without masks, vaccinations, and just saying I don't have a care in the world. So that's the wrong extreme. But then I guess locking yourself in the bedroom and not coming out is the other extreme. But the midpoint is probably a little more for a lot of us too, locked in the corner of our room and we don't want to come out. That line is shifted, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's really all about finding that balance.
There was a business in Chicago, another radio station, and they were going to give people colored wristbands based on their level of interaction that they wanted to engage with. You know, stay 15 feet away, you can approach if you've been vaccinated, et cetera. But in a way, we're all kind of doing that right now, aren't we?
We sure are. It might be more helpful to have one of those mood ring-like wristbands that we can adjust to how you're feeling that day, because it's going to be fluid.
And it's going to be different, so that maybe people aren't all back in the office now. Maybe they won't be again. But is it reasonable to expect that people are going to be changed when we gather again?
It is. How can you not? This is such a profound experience. I think that we are all going through, in some ways, a shared traumatic experience. So change has to happen.
Let's just go back then one more time to some things that I could do if I do feel that I'm overusing or I'm too riddled with anxiety or depression. I mean, you spoke about the sort of self-care that we should all be practicing even before the pandemic. I was wondering if there was something trickier or more dramatic than that. I don't know what else there is. Do you have any thoughts along those lines?
I think there's some ways to kind of shift our attitudes and our ways of thinking about these things and how to cope. I think we can do things like focus in on the little moments every day. Find the little moments of beauty and joy and humor in the small moments of day-to-day. A child's laughter. A funny thing that happened on the way to the office. And then also to take a step back then and look at the big picture. Think about what have you learned so far about yourself? What have you learned that perhaps is more important to you in your life because of this pandemic? How are you going to talk about this 10 years from now? It's important to just try to control what you can. Try to find some level of predictability wherever you can so that you're not feeling so out of control. And again, I think I already mentioned, it's important to ground yourself with some of these sensory things, these comfortable things, like, a simple thing like a hot bath and a warm blanket and things like that.
You said think about how you will talk about this from 10 years from now. Presumably in a positive light. What would I write that script and then try and live it?
Right. Because you don't want to be reflecting back and thinking about just how awful everything was. You can find those moments of success, maybe even, or times that you really stood out and made a difference even.
If those don't seem to be sufficient, then is that then the next step is contact a psychiatrist, maybe reach out to Rosecrantz? I mean, we've talked about items that I can manage or how I might reflect with my friends, but it's probably not that easy for everybody.
Certainly not. So it's important to know, again, we talked about limits, know your limits, be aware of the red flags. If you are really struggling, if you're feeling paralyzed, that's the time to reach out and get help. And certainly we have staff, we have counselors and psychiatrists, nurse practitioners available who can be helpful at Rosecrantz.
And is that when somebody does that, is it more professional dialogue? Is it medications? How do you treat somebody when they come in?
It's certainly, you have to perform a comprehensive assessment, and there may be a role for medication. Certainly, a more professional, counseling program may be helpful and may be necessary. Cognitive therapy, other kinds of counseling therapies, all of those things maybe in combination is what's needed depending on the situation.
Group therapy, is that helpful to people in these circumstances?
Yes. Group therapy, with the challenges of the pandemic, it may end up being virtual group therapy, but it's another way of finding connection and support.
And support, indeed. And my understanding is that early in the pandemic, the first two variants, it was very virtual, and some people found that to be helpful. They were able to gather where they might not otherwise and so forth.
Right. Certainly you can attend a meeting, a group, from the comfort of your living room or even an office if you're checking in for work.
Well, I want to end this conversation on a positive or at least optimistic note. And if it's okay to not be okay, nobody's advocating for not being okay. But as you are there, know that that's a normal human reaction, right, doctor? It's okay to not be okay, and then learn to manage it and maybe even turn it into a strength down the road. Use some of these skills. Imagine in the future that you got through this and that you found inner strength that you didn't have, or the strength of friends and relationships, and that you can emerge from this maybe a more powerful person than you were before.
Definitely. Saying it's okay not to be okay doesn't mean just remain in the state of not being okay.
Yeah.
Exactly. Don't give up. Get help. Reach out. And know that you're not alone in that struggle.
Yeah. That's well put. That's Dr. Ray Garcia, Medical Director of the Rosecrantz Harrison Campus in Rockford. Dr. Garcia, so nice to talk to you. Thanks for helping us on Your Radar.
You're very welcome. As always, it's a pleasure, John.
This is On Your Radar, The New Normal, a podcast series produced by WGN Radio and the doctors and clinical staff at Rosecrantz. With over 60 locations throughout Chicagoland, northern and central Illinois, Wisconsin, and Iowa, help is just a click or call away. Go to rosecrantz.org or call 866-830-8729 for more guidance and information. Rosecrantz, life's waiting.